Welcome back to Don't Pass Me By. We're glad you haven't passed us by, and a good reason to have not done that is because we have some great guests on today. The author of Killing Kennedy, Don't Pass Me By, and we also have researcher, the legendary JFK researcher, William Mattson Law. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hello. Thank you. Hi.
So let me go. Let's start with William first for a second here. Thank you for being on today. I know you were part of the Killing Kennedy book, so thank you for that. But you've had some great books yourself, In the Eye of History, Betrayal, In the Cold Shoulder of History. Most researchers are worth their druthers. Know who you are before we say anything about you, but. You've done a good job, sir. And just tell us a little bit. The one book that jumped out to me especially was Betrayal. Could you tell us a little bit about that and your other books, how you got involved in all this?
Well, I first got involved in the 1980s. I was going through a bookstore and I was just kind of looking at different things, and I pulled out this book called Best Evidence by David S. Lifton. And in the middle of this book were autopsy pictures of President Kennedy. And I'd never seen President Kennedy's autopsy pictures before, and I was just fascinated with this. And as I stood there looking at the pictures, I thought, something doesn't look right. I had never studied about an autopsy. I didn't know anything about it, but something about the pictures didn't look right. But it fascinated me enough where I bought the book and I took it home. And the main premise of the book, of course, is that after President Kennedy's body was taken, after he had passed at Parkland Hospital, it was taken and an autopsy was done at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C. And the premise of the book was that something between Dallas and Bethesda Naval Hospital, someone had done something to the body, that the body had, in essence, had a pre-autopsy autopsy, or at least a probing of the body. And this fired my imagination so much that's what really started me in it. And after I spent 6 years researching and writing my first book, In the Eye of History, which basically dealt with that subject, in 2015, I had a get together with some of the autopsy people and some of the honor guard, and my film partner in this, Phil Singer. We brought them together in Chicago, and that's where I met you, Clark. And then later, my publisher asked me to do a book with you, and that's how Betrayal came about.
Well, your work is known. Your work has been given many accolades, deservedly so, and your research has been sound. Now to the man of the hour, Jack Roth. His new book is Killing Kennedy. It's gotten great mentions. It's a big hit in the community, as they say. And we want to welcome you to the show and tell us what got you involved in all this business? When did you wake up one day and say, it seems something shady might have happened in the murder of President Kennedy?
Well, I think it goes back to when I was a teenager. I remember my earliest memories of the Kennedy assassination. I couldn't get past the fact that Jack Ruby killed Oswald. And to me, that was the smoking gun. To me, I was like, well, obviously there's something going on here. There's some kind of conspiracy, because it didn't make sense. I mean, as I've always been a critical thinker, so it was like, wait a minute. Yeah, that just doesn't smell right. And I always, from that alone, was the thing that I knew there was something not right about the assassination, as far as what they were saying about Oswald doing it alone. So, and then I think, like a lot of people in 1991, I saw the movie JFK, and that really was like a springboard for me to do a lot more research. But it got to the point where it was about 3 years ago. It was right before. It was right at the beginning of COVID, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine. It's also a really good writer. He lives in England, and it's interesting their take on it. But I said, I really want to write a book on the Kennedy assassination. And he's like, well, listen, he goes, what kind of book can you write that's different than the thousands that have already been written? And I thought it was a great question to ask because he was right. I'm like, yeah, you're right. What am I going to do that's different? So we started tossing around ideas, and we kept coming back to kind of these themes of ripple effects, why it still matters, present day relevance of people's history, because my background's journalism. So I knew that I was good at interviewing people, and that was my strong suit, and I knew who to interview and what kind of questions to ask. And I thought, you know, maybe that's what I do. And I take that kind of approach to it and get that modern day, present day relevance and get some compelling stories. One of the things I wanted to do too was humanize the Kennedy assassination by telling people's personal and emotional stories as they related to the assassination. So I just went about, I said, okay, I'm going to do this. I called one person I knew that was involved in the JFK assassination community, and she started to, you know, hook me up with a couple people who then hooked me up with a couple other people, and one thing led to another, and I started doing the interviews, and the waters parted. I mean, it was just amazing how everything worked out. One interview led to another, and I got amazing people in the book, and I couldn't be happier with the way it all turned out as far as who I got.
Well, I concur with that, and I just want to name a few. David Mantic, we have in there. William Mattson Law, who's on the line with us, fortunately, today. Vince Palorama, Judith Baker, St. John Hunt, Peter Janney, Chris Milligan, Peter Dale Scott, our friend Don Jeffries. We didn't mention him first. Sorry about that, Don, but you're in there, and we definitely give you a shout-out. Jefferson Morley, David Denton, a whole bunch of people. It's a great list you got. People must think a lot of you to all have jumped on board for good reason. And I just looked at the dedication for those who seek a greater truth. So that goes out to our audience. And I just want to mention it has a thorough index, which I've been taught to look at that before I start reading a book. So that was thoroughly done. It's kind of a scholarly book. It's well done. It also is conversational. So whether you're doing research, it's very serious, or you want a conversational book, it's a success on both fronts. But because we have William came on today as a favor I asked him, and I know these two guys know each other, and William is also interested in the book. So I want to start out with him asking some questions. William, thanks so much for being here. And take it away. What do you want to pick the author's brain about?
You know, I'm interested in, you've done all this research now. You've talked to all these researchers. You've done your own research. What is the most important thing you think you've come away from as far as understanding about the Kennedy case?
That's a great question. I think a couple of things. There was so many insightful interviews, and there's so many just compelling stories and things that I didn't know about. The two things that really I think I took away from the book, the first was the idea of who killed Kennedy. And I think people, a lot of times it's going, okay, who killed him? Like, who was behind the grassy knoll? And I knew that was going to be an extremely difficult thing to find out. I mean, after all these years, we're still debating it and all that. But what I learned was that you have to look at the times in which Kennedy governed to truly understand why he was killed and who killed him. And what I mean by that is the Cold War and the Cold Warriors, if you will, who had a lot of power during that time. And I tell people when they ask, okay, who killed Kennedy? I give them two answers. The first is that it was the times in which he governed that ultimately killed him. And the second is, it was not Lee Harvey Oswald, which is the other thing I always thought there was something not right about that, as I told you with Jack Ruby. And that's like, okay, I always believed that Oswald, when he said he was a patsy, I always believed him, because otherwise I don't even think he would have said that. And everything I had read, it just nothing added up quite right. And I think that was the second thing I learned was I learned a lot about Lee Harvey Oswald, not just as either a patsy or a lone gunman, but as a human being. And that was one of the most fun parts of the book for me. I remember William in our chapter, and I want to talk about our chapter, because first of all, I have to say you were one of the most, everyone was great. I have to say everyone that I interviewed was phenomenal, but I really, really enjoyed our interview. And it was fun putting together the chapter. I felt it was very conversational, and that's what I wanted. I wanted this to be very easy to read, conversational, as if two people were just sitting in a living room talking about this. But, you know, it even from you, like, you're like, oh, yeah, I spoke to Marina. I'm like, no, you did not. And you're like, yeah, I was fortunate to speak to her a couple times. And I was like, whoa. And you were kind enough to tell that story. So in my conclusions, I don't say anything specifically about, okay, this guy is the guy who pulled the trigger on it. I don't know enough to say that. But what I can say based on all the interviews I did was that he was most certainly killed by cold warriors. And we can get more into that if you want. And also, I Oswald is one of the most misunderstood people in our history. And it's unfortunate.
Well, first, thank you for the compliment. I really had a good time talking with you. You do so much of what I do, which is what I want to do, and why I did my first book the way I did it, was that I wanted to be the guy sitting across the table from a person that had had involvement in this historic event, and I wanted to throw it open and just ask the questions I wanted to ask, like a table talk between two human beings, and just find out what I could find out. That's why I did it. I wanted to be able to sit there and watch the person and see how they talk to me and how they move their body. And when I look in their eyes, how they looked back at me, you know, that sort of thing. I needed to be in the room with them. So that was very important to me. And it was an amazing experience for me. I became so obsessed with this that it wouldn't leave me alone. I thought about it every day. I read something about it every day. I read documents every day. You know, when I went through all the books that I could go through, I started calling people, and that's when it all started to come together. And I just, my own family were like, why are you so obsessed with this? Once you know that there's a problem with the official story, especially, you know, the greatest mystery, you know, of the 20th century involving our president, I couldn't let it go. So I think I told you that sometimes when you can't let something go, when something won't let you go, the best thing you can do is just give into it and embrace it. And at that point, that's what I decided to do. So,
yeah. And we talked about this because I think that's one of the things, like, you know, I was born in 65. So I was born 2 years after the assassination. And again, like, you know, we start doing this work. There have been people that have already been doing decades, they've sacrificed decades of their lives.
Absolutely.
Researching this. So I remember we discussed this because I'm like, you know, okay, so what can I add to this? And you're right. It was the same kind of, I want to sit with people and have them tell their stories, and it's their journey. Like, have them tell about their journey. And it's funny because it's like in your chapter, I love your journey, like, in almost every chapter, for the most part, depending on who I spoke to, especially the researchers, though, that was part of it. It was their journey. You know, how'd you first get it? What made you say to yourself, I'm going to dedicate a lot of my time figuring out what happened here? And I love the way you told your story, and it was a compelling journey. And I remember you specifically saying to me, you know, I was sitting across from, you know, these Secret Service guys do not talk to anyone. And I'm in their living room. I'm in this guy's living room. And he's like, whoa. Or I'm on the phone with Marina Oswald. It's like, and I'm like, I was so excited just to hear it. Like, and so you're telling me about your journey, interviewing these people, telling you about their stories and journeys, right? And it's just, it's great. It makes for really compelling reading. And I think that's the key, especially today. You want books to be readable. You want these to be very conversational, readable, compelling, so people can take what they want from it and then go ahead and do their own research.
What made me start doing my own research was, invariably you read a book on this subject, and most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time toward the end of the book, there'll be a chapter that says, what really happened? And then the author will give you their opinion, but they don't state it like opinion. They state it like it's fact. And I got so tired of that. I wanted to go, I don't know what happened, so let's go find out. And that was the whole thing for me. You want me to talk a little bit about talking to Marina?
I think that's a phenomenal story, and I was kind of hoping you would. But that's up to Bob, whatever he wants.
Yeah, you will have to.
I am totally in favor of you going and telling us about your time with Marina. Marina, we have 2 hours, so let it fly, sir.
I had. Now, you have to keep in mind that this was probably over 28 years ago, my first conversation with her. So I had heard that she screened all of her calls. Somehow, I don't remember how, probably somebody gave me her number. And, you know, I'm really nervous because it's like, you know, yeah, I've talked to witnesses and stuff, but this is Marina Oswald. So I called her up, and as luck would have it, she answered the phone herself. And she, you know, she had this Russian accent, and I'd heard her voice before, so I knew it was her. So I introduced myself, and I said, I'm a Kennedy assassination researcher. And the first thing she says is, oh, wonderful. Just wonderful. So I managed to start asking her things. And one of the things I wanted to know, luckily she didn't hang up on me. And one of the things I remember is I asked her about the backyard photographs and if she had actually taken them. And she said that she had taken the backyard photographs, but in those photographs, Lee was not holding a rifle. Lee was holding something else, which kind of blew me away. And as we went on, I don't really remember at this point what all the things I asked her, but I had a little baby at the time. And so I mentioned how I was a father, and we got to talking about kids, and she said, so you're proud papa. And so that kind of, that gave us a little connection, you know, and she really liked that. And, so I asked her if we could meet, and she said, no. She says, I have to cook dinners and things like that. And, and at one point, I do remember at one point, I my voice was shaking a little bit in the first part of the conversation. And she says to me, she says, do not be nervous. I am not celebrity. I am just a woman. So, you know, it was, I came off of that phone call, and I probably talked to her about 20 minutes. I came off of that phone call. I was on a high, you know, because I had, in my way, been able to touch history. And I've still been chasing right. that all these years later. I've been doing this hard now for close to 35 years. And I have always chased touching history because it really means something to me. There is right. nothing better for me than to sit with someone that has had an event in the history of this country. And I tell you, I've had so many experiences. I wouldn't trade any of it. And I started out just as a guy reading a book, and that book changed the meaning and the course of my life. How often does that happen?
Yeah, right. No, it's great. I love it.
There were
and
other.
I, you know, it's funny. Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and that's what it's all about. I mean, to be able to sit with someone, you were in the presence of literally, you know, to sit or speak to someone who literally represents history. And I, you know, I think that's, I love history. I know you love history. And, you know, and then because what happens in history dictates, obviously, it's important. And I don't think people look at history importantly enough these days. And obviously it's not really even taught in schools and high schools anymore. You have to be lucky to get some good history classes. But yeah, I mean, it shapes everything. And I think you have to understand history in order to understand the present and in order to understand what may happen in the future. And because this is a lot about human nature, and these are people, right? So like, Marina's like, you know, she has this certain personality, right? And she says, well, I'm not a celebrity, I'm just a woman, right? So don't be nervous. And it's like, these are real people, but it's human beings, and with all their flaws, right, that make history.
Absolutely.
You know, and that was something I wanted to look at in the book, because I actually, there's a whole section, as you guys know, in the book that's just talks about psychological and philosophical perspectives on the assassination, because I wanted to get a better feel for, okay, what's the psychology behind the assassination itself, and why do people react the way they react, and why do people believe official narratives without questioning them? I really wanted to get to the bottom of that. And those were, again, some of the most insightful interviews, because these individuals were academics for the most part, you know, had PhDs, masters, and they had done work in their field, whether it was psychology or philosophy or social science, and they understand that. So I said, okay, well, what are we talking about here? And things like cognitive dissonance came up, right? The idea that people don't want to feel uncomfortable in their thoughts, so it's easier to believe what the Warren Commission said. Because it's okay, yeah, it was a single nutty guy. Because that's way easier to believe, and it doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. But if you have to accept the fact that your government was responsible for the death of the president, that's way too uncomfortable for a lot of people, especially back then in '63, where you were, you know, World War II veterans and very patriotic, and you know, we were still at the point, we were at that edge, but we were at that point where we still trusted our institutions. And ironically, it was when Kennedy was killed that started to erode. So, but yeah, man, I mean, you know, I feel like the whole thing was a journey, right? So I'm interviewing William, I'm interviewing you, and I'm like, I remember, you know, and it was funny because, you know, I'd get, there'd be 20,000 words, right, at the end of an interview, and I transcribe it, 20,000. And I had to get them down to 5, right, for the book, in order for the book to really... the hardest part of the book. I mean, doing the interviews was the most fun part of the book. And that was the most enjoyable. And then of course, seeing it come together was also a very enjoyable thing. But, I always go back and I say, you know, when people ask me, well, so what are the interviews, blah, blah, blah. And I'll never, because I was sitting outside when I spoke to you the first time. And I was like, you know, this is, if the whole book's going to be like this, fantastic. You know, because I didn't know how people would respond. I didn't know, and it was really like one at a time. It was like, that do it the right way, be professional, be kind, and that's who I'm a person. And if you do that, then they're going to tell other people, and you might get that interview, you might get that person interviewed,
right?
And that's what happened. That's really what happened.
It was a fantastic experience for me, and I really enjoyed myself doing it. And I could tell you were earnest and wanting to know, and that helped a lot. Psychologically, I don't have a PhD behind my name, but that's what I have found as well, is that people do not want to think that their government could have done something like this, especially people in 1963. If, you know, you believed what the government told you, you know, and except maybe my dad, but he'd been through World War II and experienced a lot of things. And I think I told you this in the interview that my father, when I was a teenager, we got on the subject of JFK, and I think I was like 14, 15. And he said, you know, that son of a bitch Johnson had something to do with it. And I said, now, Dad, you're talking about the president of the United States. And it was years later when I had become to learn to be a little more cynical that sure enough, you know, I have talked to people that knew Johnson personally. I interviewed two Secret Service agents that said the exact same thing, the exact same words, and I interviewed them separately. And when I said, what did you think of President Johnson? They both used this phrase. They said, oh, he was the most deplorable human being I ever knew.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, I've since talked to others that felt the same way.
And they just have to do their own you know, I interviewed Phil Mills for the book, and that, again, was a real eye-opener. And I couldn't believe I could believe, because I always knew, like, I always heard Johnson's kind of had a screw loose, you know, something. I never heard real specifics, but piece of work, right, basically. But what's really interesting about it is between Phil and some of the psychiatrists and psychologists, you really start to look at this behavior of powerful people who are they're you take John's example, sociopath, egomaniac, you know, you could even put psychopath in there, but there's these mental illness, like literal illnesses that they could have been diagnosed with. And they were these types of men, and they had power because people like that tend to, a lot of times they self-destruct, but get far in life. So you get someone who is a very egotistical, has an elitist mentality, is a sociopath, meaning he doesn't care what happens to anyone else. So he's capable of doing things or having other people do things that other people can't do. So you have this guy in Lyndon Johnson who in Texas, way before he was vice president, the shenanigans in Texas that were going on. I mean, that's the whole thing leading up to the fact that, you know, the Kennedys, they wanted him off the ticket. They didn't want him on a ticket for the second term. And they were literally trying to get him in big trouble because they had all this information, you know, about all this wrongdoing that happened in Texas when he was down there, when he was a young politician. It was like that good old boys network. But what you find out is people like Johnson, Nixon, Alan Dulles, James Jesus Angleton. I mean, these guys, they could have easily been diagnosed, and they may have, for what we know, you know, but they certainly had these traits of people who you wouldn't think would have powerful positions. But we live in a world where people like that to get in positions like that because they're bullies almost. They're like Lyndon Johnson was like the biggest bully in the world, apparently.
Marjorie Taylor Greene comes to mind right now.
Yes.
They can get in positions of power.
Right. Exactly, exactly, exactly right. You know, you have people and you're thinking to yourself, because you could be charismatic. So apparently Lyndon Johnson was also charismatic, you know? It's like the ultimate, like, con men in the world where you see these 48-hour episodes, right, where it's like, well, they did this, they did that, and to marry them, and they took all their money, and they killed four of them, and they're on the run. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. How was he able to do that? Charisma, sociopathy, psychopathy. Egomaniacal kind of mindset, you know. But, you know, William, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, because I think this became a theme as I started to interview more and more people. And we got into the details of the assassination, and chapters like yours really get into that whole idea that the journey of the president's body, right, from Dallas, you know, and what happened to the body, right, on its way back to D.C. And that stuff is absolutely fascinating when you get into the minutiae of that. It's absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that started to happen when I talk to people is this idea that elitism, there was this sense of, especially back in 63, you had a group of people. We always have that. There's always been that in almost every country. And the United States is no different than that. But this idea of people who are, I like to call them elitists. And what I mean by that is, you know, like take Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles. Alan Dulles recruited for the CIA almost exclusively from Harvard and Yale. And, you know, some of these guys in Yale, they were skull and bones, right? We talk about George Bush Sr., all these people. And that's a real thing. I mean, that skull and bones is not a conspiracy theory. It's an actual society. It's a real thing. And it's an elitist mindset where you're born to think and believe that you are better than the masses, you're better than everyone else, and that you are meant to rule over them. And it goes from there. So they're perfectly fine with, well, we have to do this. This mentality in the CIA was the same thing. We'll do whatever we have to do in order to get what we need and want. And that was basically, well, you know, at least on paper, it was fight the red menace, right? Defeat communism, especially in the Cold War. It was this bunch of guys who just thought they could do whatever the heck they wanted to do, and in essence did whatever they wanted to do. So I see these guys kept coming up over and over again. And then you had Kennedy, Kennedy was Harvard. He was elite. It's like, yeah, but they weren't. And here's why. First of all, these other elites looked down on the Kennedys because they were Irish Catholic, right? Their father was a bootlegger. It didn't matter that their fathers and grandfathers, God knows what they did in order to get the wealth, amass the wealth that they got. Right? But as far as they were concerned, the Kennedys were upstarts. So, you know, and here comes Kennedy, and, you know, there's a little bit of an ego there with Kennedy, and also Robert, they had egos. They were very successful. And one's president, one's attorney.
More than a little.
Hubris got them killed. I honestly believe that thought is Kennedy's like, well, I'm president. And what he didn't realize was there are people with more power than you, and they will make sure if you don't do essentially what they want you to do, they will make sure either you're not president in a couple of years or it could be worse. And yeah, I think he didn't think that they would ever do that. And I think that got him killed, because he had to know that he was pissing the wrong people off.
I've often said that John Kennedy's biggest mistake was thinking that he was actually the president of the United States.
Right. And it's just a figurehead, really. I mean, who are the real power players? The Clint Murchisons of the world, right?
Yeah. And having Johnson, you know, picked to be the vice president, that was a terrible misstep.
Yes.
What do you think about it, Bob? Come on in and join the conversation.
Well, it was fascinating listening. And some of the people in the book, in my mind, sort of tied together. So I'd like to get what you guys think of them collectively. As I go through some of the people who you've spoken to, St. John Hunt was the son of Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt. I'm going to mention three, and then maybe we could go on about them a little, each one. A second one was Peter Janney, whose dad was way up the food chain in the agency, and also Chris Milligan, a publisher for Try and Day. They put out a lot of good books, I believe, even some of our other guests here. But what I wanted to ask was, St. John Hunt basically came out, they say, you know, there was a deathbed confession by his dad, which really wasn't a deathbed confession. That was a tape that they gave over, I believe, to Coast Radio and such. But Hunt, as we listen to some of the tapes that are coming out now, and Nixon said, if we, you know, if we bring up this Cuba thing, so to speak, I'm paraphrasing, it could open a scab and open a lot of things. It seemed Hunt, in his estimation, had something to do with it, even if he was a tramp. But I lead you along. So I'd like to start with St. John Hunt. When you made contact with him, how did you come away feeling about his presentation? And what do you think about some of those things that I brought up? And you may go, you know, go into others that are along those lines.
That was, you know, I had to create a section of the book called My Father Was in the CIA, because I had four people whose fathers were in the CIA. And you mentioned three of them. The fourth is Channa Willis, who's kind of newer to this and what her father's role was. But St. John, it was one of the interviews I was looking forward to the most, because I had heard about him. I had known a lot about his father because I had done the history and the research on Watergate and you know, from 1950s through, you know, E. Howard Hunt is all over the place, right? CIA operative, spy craft, you know, Watergate burglar, possible involvement in the Kennedy assassination. So what surprised me when I interviewed St. John was the emotion. I will say, at one point in the interview, we were both crying because it was that, you know. And the reason it was is because of the collateral damage that these men do cause and to their families. And it's in every case, in every one of the people that we just mentioned, you have this, again, this blue blood elitist Washington, D.C. on the outside. It looks so good. Like, you're a CIA guy, right? You're high up, or you're middle, whatever you are, and you live in, you make a great living, and you're a spy, you're James Bond, and, you know, whether people know it or not, but you have this outside of the very wealthy, everyone's private school educated, everyone's, you know, again, it is an elitist place, it's an elitist life. But what you don't see is that almost every one of these men, at least in the cases where I interviewed, were raging alcoholics. And the reason they were is because some of the things they were doing, and over time, it takes its toll. And just the nefarious stuff that the CIA was doing, killing people. You're basically getting, in some cases, tens of thousands of people killed in another country, or in Vietnam, certainly. But whether it's Guatemala or wherever. And all these coups and these stolen elections and these things that they were doing. But, you know, so you have this collateral damage. In John's case, his mother was killed because of Watergate, because of what the father was up to in Watergate. And she was on an airplane with some other critical, quote unquote, Watergate people. And E. Howard Hunt sent the mom, his wife, with bribe money, because he was terrified because he'd go to jail. So he was trying to bribe people, and that plane crashed. And according to St. John, it was the plane crashed under very mysterious circumstances, and it was probably taken down because there were more. It was his mom was on there, but there were other people on there that were associated with Watergate. So, and so you have families that are broken, but they seem on the outside, well, you know, they have nannies, and, you know, but the parents are, and then a lot of times the moms turn to alcohol because, you know, the husbands are alcoholics, and they're also major, you know, they're cheating on their wives. I would say in a very all the time with multiple women. I mean, this is kind of this whole time period of the Cold War and men back then, like Mad Men, right? You know, two martini lunches, and, you know, you know, having affairs with their secretaries. It was just a really misogynistic mentality and world that was back then. And couple that with what they were doing, and it's a recipe for disaster. So St. John, you know, one of the things he said to, you know, he held his dad's feet to the fire, especially in later dead. You know, one of the things I was surprised, he said, you know, my dad and I had a great relationship, great relationship. I said, oh, okay, so you don't resent him for, he said, no, I don't. I know that it's because of what he did for a living that caused a lot of our family problems, obviously issues. But I think for St. John, it was like, Dad, you know, you sacrificed your life for the CIA, and now other people are making money off of telling lies about you. So don't you think you want to get your side of the story out? Yeah, and of course he did. You know what? You're right. It wasn't a deathbed confession, but it was later in his life. And he told him, you know, he said, listen, I was, you know, I don't know whether it was complete truth, but he's, you know, I was peripheral. I was logistics. I was down in Dallas. My job, because he said, I worked with the Cubans. I worked with them during the, you know, Bay of Pigs. And that was my job. I was their handler, these Cuban nationals. And he was like, you know, so I knew how to get, he was very good at logistics, safe houses, airports, get people in and out fast. So he said, and he said they wanted me to have a bigger role, but I refused. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is, but there is no question that E. Howard Hunt knew a lot about what happened with the nation. He was getting people in and out of Dallas at the very least. And he was there doing it. I don't know if he was one of the tramps. I don't know about that. But, you know, because there's a couple of people that look like that guy. Getting to that, it's like, oh, you know, I'm taking a guess. Because I wasn't there. So I don't know, right? So I hate to say it was definitely him. I don't know if he was one of the tramps, but he was definitely there in Dallas. And he was coordinating, coming, going, cars, airplanes, safe houses. And that's totally. And then when you fast forward, and then he's one of the Watergate guys, which, by the way, when the Watergate burglars, it's the same group of clowns, Frank Sturgis, you know, you know, CIA operative, you know, assassin, basically, a couple other of these Cuban nationals. It's the same guys. And they're now involved in Watergate. So Nixon knows, you know, that, okay, this is a problem. We have to hush him up because he Howard Hunt could. The House of Cards can come down, and Nixon knew something. Nixon knew something about the nation as well. It's fascinating, right? It's just so fascinating how there's all these elements and tentacles. But yeah, no, listen. You know, the CIA, the children of CIA, these men who were part of the CIA back then. Everyone's a fascinating story, and there's always a price to pay for doing that kind of work and especially doing the things that they were doing during the Cold War. It takes its toll, and it definitely took its toll on the families.
Well, with Howard Hunt, as an aside, Kevin Costner, I understand, approached him and offered $5 million if he would tell the whole story. And this was after this part of the story by St. John had come out. And he wasn't satisfied that the whole story had been given. So I believe the $5 million, if this account indeed is true, and it seemed to be from, you know, what I've heard of it, Costner, you know, kept researching after the movie ended quietly. But he put $5 million up for the rest of the story. And a friend of mine, Michael Canfield, the late Michael Canfield, I just wanted to get him in there, but he had pertinent information. It's not just a name drop. He had gone to Frank Sturgis's home under, you know, he said he wanted to do an article on the Cuban exiles. And as they were speaking, you know, Frank Sturgis kept talking, I guess, over a couple of days. And he said his home was raided the weekend of the assassination of JFK. And, you know, they went through the house and he was a suspect in the assassination. So he had, you know, he had said that to Michael Canfield, and Canfield had done other work with Sturgis. I just wanted to throw that in. Michael did some pretty good work. And I just wanted to also comment when you said the tramps. I think it's interesting that Mark Lane had said You know, I never said Howard Hunt was one of the tramps. I just said he was in Dallas. And Mike Canfield,
right.
You know, whom I was able to speak to at great length over a few years, you know, he was sued by Hunt along with Liberty Lobby, if I'm getting my names correct. I hope I'm not saying Hobby Lobby or something. Forgive me. A little justice. But,
right, Liberty Lobby.
But, but he said that, you know, Hunt's whole backstory fell apart, you know, about, look, you know, he was out shopping for Chinese food and that, you know, there's a supposed memo that I've never seen. Maybe you or William would know if it exists, but that the CIA was ready to give him up and say that he was in Dallas that day. It looked like at one point they might have been afraid of a limited hangout. But I digress, and I'm just going to go through some names. St. John Hunt said his dad named most of these people as being involved in the plot. He called himself a bench warmer. Mike mm-hmm. Canfield, again, said to me, E. Howard Hunt was never a bench warmer for anything in his life. So his implication was that he was downplaying his role. David Atlee Phillips, another one. Cord Meyer, who gets into another person you interviewed, Peter Janney, who had a great book, Mary's Mosaic. David Morales, William Harvey, who came up with a plan, which you can read in Noel Twyman's book, you know, very similar to what might have been used against Kennedy. And you mentioned Frank Sturgis. You mentioned some of them already, but his cast of characters to me on the surface seems like some of these guys might have actually been, you know, they Morales and Phillips and such, the involvement with Oswald. What do you think of the list, that list of people he put before us?
I think it's a great list. I mean, it's certainly a great list to start with and maybe end with. I mean, you think about everything, right? You try to be objective, think big picture, try to start putting the pieces of the puzzle together. You have Harvey, right? We mentioned William Harvey. He was supposedly in charge of the false defector program, Soviet Union. So he knew Oswald, and he knew Oswald very well because Oswald was part of the false defector program to the Soviet Union. And he hated Kennedy, right? The research. I mean, he was a staunch, again, every one of these guys, cold warrior, staunch anti-communist. So David Atlee Phillips, I mean, my God, another CIA cold warrior, right? Dave Morales and Frank Sturgis, to me, were the kinds of guys that got their hands dirty, like a lot dirtier than someone like an Alan Dulles would, most certainly, you know, some of the higher ups. Even David Atlee Phillips was a little higher up, I think, that he wasn't going to actually be holding a gun in Dallas. Not to say Morales or Sturgis were that day, but I wouldn't put that past those two guys. And then you have to understand the Cuban exiles was real Cuban militants. I mean, they were so anti Castro, and the Bay of Pigs, they blamed Kennedy, even though Alan Dulles for and then that they hated Kennedy, and they wanted Kennedy. They wouldn't care if they wanted Castro dead, and they wanted Kennedy dead. Their whole country, and you have to look at it from their perspective. It's like they literally lost their country, and now they're here in. And we're supposed to be an ally, you know, a democratic country. And why aren't we going in? Why aren't we taking Castro out? So for them, it was very black and white, visceral. And of course, Morales had all those connections. I mean, he, you know, that guy was apparently, I don't know, one of the people I interviewed told me that the files that came out, that came out of Morales were almost 90% redacted. There was so much on this guy that they had to redact, that there's no information on him as far as with any of that is concerned. But these guys, yeah, every one of the guys that is mentioned, that you mentioned, I would say go ahead and start with them and then go out from there, you know, and then you can maybe make the list a little bigger. And obviously, Alan Dulles, you know, you get people like that who Kennedy fired, right? Talk about, you know, digging his own grave, but he's like, you know, Kennedy was infuriated with Alan Dulles because of the Bay of Pigs, because he manipulated him. Alan, because that's what they did. They manipulated presidents. They had all the power. So the Bay of Pigs, he's like, yeah, Kennedy's going to have to use air. He's going to have to bring in air support because he's going to have no choice. Well, Kennedy, he did have a choice, and he said, nope, I'm not doing it. Took courage to do that. Then he fired Dulles, and he fired the other guy's name, but two, like, sacred cows in the
General Cabell.
Warrior. Correct. So, yes, and, they, you know, these are guys that were sacred cows for Cold Warriors. They were high up. They represented everything that, you know, a patriotic Cold Warrior would be, right? And Kennedy was like, forget these guys. They're crazy. So, you know, again, it's fascinating. But, yeah, that's a great list. Every one of those guys deserves a lot more digging into by anyone who wants to do more research on this.
There's kind of an overlap in one of the people who I could have named four. I named three. Forgive me for that, but I was going in a certain direction. But we can go into the fourth person also as the show continues. But Peter Janney wrote an interesting book, Mary's Mosaic. Cord Meyer was named by Hunt as one of the people he would finger. I just want to mention my friend, I'm not just dropping names for the sake of saying hello to them, but I wanted to give Canfield a nod since he passed away and he did great work. And my friend Mike Ray, you know, I asked him about the plumbers, and Mike had been, you know, a good man, sort of affiliated with intelligence world, Air Force intelligence. And I asked him about Hunt, and he said to me, well, Bob, always keep in mind that these guys are professional liars. But that didn't mean the list wasn't partially true. He wasn't negating the whole story. And we get into Peter Janney and Cord Meyer. Would you like to talk about those two guys and tell us the connection to them and what you gleaned when you spoke to Mr. Janney? And what do you think of Cord Meyer?
Yeah, and I forgot to, because I know you mentioned Cord, and I forgot to mention him in that list as well. But
you're doing quite well. Right. Don't knock yourself there. Just we have plenty of time, and you've written quite a book, and you're giving us quite an interview, so please continue.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. So Peter Janney is, again, one of the people I met that I was able to do through doing some other interviews. And then I had already done so much reading, but then I did specific reading to the people that I was interviewing, their books. So Mary's Mosaic was one of the books that I read by Peter Janney that blew my mind. I didn't know that. It's like one of those books where you're like, oh, I did not know that. And he, again, his dad was Wister Janney, elitist blue blood, not saying he was a horrible person by any means, but he could have been a good man, but he was definitely part of that CIA, high ranking CIA official from that time period, Cold Warrior. And so Peter, that was his dad. So Peter, and then grew up, around all of those people. And one of the people also that was part of that group was Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was married to Mary Pinchot Meyer, which is Mary's Mosaic. That's what the book is named after, Mary Pinchot Meyer. From everything, from all accounts, a remarkable, remarkable woman, well ahead of her time. I don't want to say too much about it. You can read about it in the book, but basically just a great, amazing woman, very highly educated, highly intelligent. She knew all those people, as you know, Georgetown, Washington, D.C. elite. And she met Cord when she was younger, as she had John Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. And at the time when they were young in college, at the time JFK was more of just, not that it, this changed, but he was just a womanizer, and he had no substance at all back then when he was younger. And Cord Meyer, she met, another one of these incredibly promising young men, right? You know, again, this guy was a blue blood, Ivy League educated. And it was Cord Meyer who was supposed to be like the next president. I mean, that's what people were saying about Cord Meyer. Anyway, they both go to World War II, and we know about Kennedy, profiles in courage. And then Cord Meyer got injured in World War II as well. He came back, and he had a glass eye or something. He lost one of his eyes, but he didn't wear a patch, I think. Anyways, you know, good looking guy comes back, and you know, and he was at first very anti, and he wanted to do things to make sure it would never be another world war like that. But someone started to recruit him, a guy by the name of James Jesus Angleton, who, if people do more research on this guy, he was known as one of the most evil human beings who ever lived. Guy in the CIA, brilliant, right? Like, beyond brilliant, smart guy, but understood spycraft, understood manipulation, mind control, propaganda. He was a master at all of it. And he started to recruit Cord for the CIA, and eventually got Cord to join the CIA. And that's when everything started to kind of go south. And he had married Mary Meyer. So him and Cord and Mary are married. They have two kids. Wister has, you know, as one of Mary's sons, who happens to, by accident, with a horrible accident, dies, gets killed in a car hit him. And that's where, when Peter, as a youngster, began to get to know Mary really well, because Mary was like the only one who understood his grief and the only one who took the time to actually talk to him and want to hear what he had to say. You know, most adults back in that time were children to be seen and not heard. Well, Mary was different. So Mary took the time to get to know Peter and listen to him. And Peter just thought the world of Mary. And then he went off to college. And then he was assassinated. And then 1 year afterwards, and the Warren Commission report comes out, and all this, you have, you know, according to Peter, he did a ton of research, really good research on this. She eventually divorces Cord because he starts to become, again, a raging alcoholic. He starts to become a warmonger, right, like a cold warrior would, and no matter, you know, no, any means to an end. Doesn't matter. It's all justified, and she couldn't handle it anymore. So she divorces him, and then she starts to say things about how the Warren Commission report is nonsense. It's poppycock. It is not what happened, because she had become Kennedy's lover. And when I say that, I don't say that loosely, because Kennedy had a lot of lovers, but Mary was one of the very few, if not the only woman he truly admired and respected. Because Mary didn't need JFK. Mary had all that. Mary had the elitist family, the blue blood. She had the education. She could do whatever she wanted to do. But she truly, her and Kennedy literally fell in love. And so she started to have influence on John F. Kennedy and talking about things like world peace and how, and Kennedy had realized during the Cold War, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that this was untenable. That this had to stop, otherwise millions of people were going to die. There was going to be a nuclear holocaust. So Kennedy, over time, starts to mature, starts to evolve, starts to become more of a well-rounded person, where Cord starts to deteriorate into just a, you know, CIA, you know, part of the CIA family, and just, we got to do whatever we can do to defeat the communists. So he went the other way, and Kennedy went, I think, he really started to evolve as a human being. And Mary was part of that. So if you read Peter's book, right, and you're seeing all this. And again, the whole point of this is that Mary winds up being killed, murdered, literally murdered, on the towpath on Washington, D.C., right there in Georgetown, where the river is. And she was murdered. And they tried a guy by the name of Ray Crump for the killing, but because of lack of evidence. So it's probably the biggest unsolved murder case in Washington, D.C.
Can I ask a question and just stop? This is a fascinating dialogue, and I just wanted to ask one question in here. I read that the grouping of shots, you know, and they say in ballistics, if someone's a shot and they can, you know, get all the shots in the same place, it's talent. The way that, you know, Mary, the shots in that case were all grouped very together, if I remember correctly. And also that, you know, she had a diary. And she was related to some pretty heavy hitters in Washington as well. And the person who jogged past her. Now, again, this is from memory, so please forgive me. I can't remember the name off the top of my head.
but the part in Janney's book, you know, a jogger had gone past and he was supposed to be one of the main witnesses, and he ended up being basically, you know, a suspect. He had been in, you know, in the military himself. So it was a very strange setup where Mary was killed.
It was, and it smelled of CIA modus operandi, right? Like, you know, a CIA hit, right? Where the jogger could have been a lookout. There was probably 3 to 4 at least people involved. And correct, she was murdered execution style, a very professional hit. It seemed that way. And again, you're right. She had apparently had a diary, and her sister was married to Ben Bradley of Washington Post fame, Watergate fame. And so they all lived in Georgetown. I remember going there with Peter recently and just seeing all the houses they lived in and seeing the towpath. And boy, man, is it, seeing it really brings it to life and brings it together from the standpoint of, wow. I mean, you're in Georgetown, this incredibly beautiful, where so many very powerful people live. This woman goes for a walk one morning after doing some artwork and is killed execution style because of what she knew. And yes, yeah, so she, and here's the thing, according to reports, according to the research, and according to even Ben Bradley to an extent, although he and forth, but James Angleton, Ben Bradley and Mary's sister went to her apartment first, her house in Georgetown, and James Angleton was already there, and he was looking for something. So he left. He says, "Oh, sorry, I was just blah blah blah." They all knew each other, so it was not the biggest of deals, right? So apparently, then they go to her art studio, which was behind their house, Ben's house, and she had an art studio back, which is where she left that morning to go on her walk. And there's James Jesus Angleton picking the lock to that, because apparently he was like the most amazing locks. He can take any lock apart and get in anywhere. He was known for that. He was a master of spycraft here, and he was looking for the diary. Now, whether he got it or not, Ben Bradley, oh, there was no diary. And there was another diary, but that was her artist diary. So there was apparently where she did sketches in that. And that's not the diary they were after. They were after a diary where she talks about Angleton and Meyer and what really happened with Kennedy and, you know, what she mentions in that diary. No one knows what happened to it. You know, Angleton probably got his hands on it. But this was right after she died, and they found out she died. That's why Ben and his wife were going to her apartment, to her house.
And they were separating at the time. So Cord, I didn't mean to interrupt, but Cord Meyer's papers wouldn't have been in her possession. They were already divorced. So what they had to be looking for, I could see his relatives, the others went over. But as William waits patiently in the bullpen, because my arm is tiring now in the seventh as we move along. So they go over. There's really no reason that I can see. I could see Ben Bradley being there, a relative with his wife. But what on earth would Angleton be looking for if not a diary or something of that sort? She wouldn't be holding her husband's records. They wouldn't have been left in her possession, certainly, if they're divorced.
No, it wasn't. I don't think it had anything to do with anything that Cord, because he was already out of the picture. And as a CIA employee, he was conveniently out of town that day. So, and again, you got to read Peter's book. There's a lot to it. But according to Peter, and he talked to some people, CIA ties and one ex-CIA guy, but he believes that Cord knew about it and that he was okay with it, because Cord, you have to understand, he basically hated Mary at that point, for he knew she was with Kennedy and she had embarrassed him, divorced him. And not a lot of people got divorced back then. Mary did, because she was a free spirit and she was a strong woman, and she's like, I'm not having any of this. So Cord was not on, you know, they loved their kids together, of course, and their one boy died. But I mean, they, you know, Cord was there or knew about whenever that green light was given that we got to get rid of Mary, because she can really damage us. Because
she might speak as well.
She's not one of Kennedy. Yeah. Oh, she was red. She didn't. and again, according to Peter, according to the things Mary was saying to people, because there was another CIA wife who was like, Mary, you got to stop talking. Like, you know, she's like, no, man, that's unacceptable. Mary wanted the truth to come out. It was kind of like Dorothy Kilgallen was the same thing, the reporter. And she, you know, you start digging for the truth and then you wind up mysteriously dead.
And Mark Shaw basically got through the New York, a lot of coverage by the New York Post in his book. Although he's still a lone nutter in Oswald, I believe he did get the Kilgallen case reopened. But let's move on a bit. This gentleman runs Trinde Publishing, and he grew up in the world with his dad in intelligence. And he also his family was supposedly friends with Ed Lansdale, who Fletcher Prouty, you know, seems to have, you know, if we go by the movie JFK with the nameplate on the desk and the general giving the order, when they're saying that can be done, I can handle that, you know, in Dallas in the South, or I don't know if they said Dallas, but anyway,
in
the fall in 63. And it seemed to be Fletcher Prouty seems to have said, you know, he was number two in Black Ops. He's sent out of the country to New Zealand. While he's gone, Kennedy, as they said in the movie JFK, gets popped. And then, you know, his perceptions weren't in the country at the time. He had some interesting things to say. But can you tell us a bit about Chris Milligan? And maybe get a little bit about his dad. And then Ed Lansdale is quite an intriguing figure.
Yeah. And Chris was great, you know, great to talk to. And he, you know, he talked about what I remember the most about his interview was when he would talk to his dad when he was a kid and kind of burn out. Like, so he was a CIA guy. And he was like, you know what the Vietnam War is really about, right? Of course, Chris is like, what? Like, you know, what are you talking about, right? And it's like, because, you know, they get burnt out. And then I think he had a friend over, another guy that he knew. And then they were just chatting and they were probably drinking. And then they was like, you know, it's all about the drugs. They want all of you kids to be, you know, hooked on opioids and whatever, heroin or whatever. And so it's a drug war. Vietnam's a drug war. It's a CIA op. And like, Chris is like, whoa, dad, like, you know, and then he would start telling him all this other stuff like, well, you don't understand, that's not even the half of it. And I think, you know, at some point they crack, even though, and some don't, but I think over time kind of work gets to you, and if you drink in a little bit and you just can't handle it, maybe there's that moment you slip. Now maybe the next day his dad's like, I didn't say anything. And it's like, Chris like, yeah, well, yeah, you did. And he's like, no, I didn't. But in those moments when his dad talked to him, he, you know, learned about like this idea of secret societies. And, you know, you mentioned secret societies and people automatically go, oh, conspiracy theories, da, 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 which is unfair, totally unfair, because it's not true. It's that secret societies have existed since the beginning of mankind. There were secret societies in the Egyptian Empire, the Roman Empire. But in the time of Jesus, I mean, you had these ancient mystery schools that you had to be invited to. I mean, these secret societies have always existed. And over time, they were brought to the United States in the form of whether it's the Knights Templar or more likely the Freemasons or whatever. And they come here. And these and they, you know, and again, there's very powerful families. And then that ties into the Skull and Bones. He talked a lot about Skull and Bones at Yale.
Yeah, he has a book on that available on Trinde Books, ladies and gentlemen. We'll throw that one in.
Yeah, very interesting. And you know, and listen, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's a fact. Skull and Bones exists. Secret society. They do really weird stuff that no one knows about, like these.
Well, can I throw it in? It's kind of disgusting. Williams in the bullpen. We have until 6 o'clock, so if I can pester you for a few more minutes, if you put up with me, and then I'll hand over to William to close the game out like Mariano Rivera used to do at the Yankees. I know you came from Brooklyn, so you'll know from which I speak. And then we will and then we'll wrap things up. We still have quite a bit of time. And this book, of course, as I mentioned, Trinde before this the book we're currently talking about, Killing Kennedy, Exposing the Plot, the Cover-Up, and the Consequences, by Jack Roth. This Skull and Bones business, I mean, the story is that, you know, the father Bush went down you know, with the son in, I believe he went to Yale, which is kind of incredible in and itself if you've heard him speak. So somebody had to get him in there. There's something's going on. You know, he couldn't get himself into school by himself, but he got us into quite a war for 20 years.
Couple wars, yeah.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. And the father went down because the son wasn't going to get through with the ceremony. But, you know, what anybody does in the privacy of their own home isn't my own business. But in this case, I think we can delve into it since it's not in the privacy of someone's home. That they would climb into a coffin, be urinated on, be felt up. Forgive me if any children are listening. This is the time to scoot them into the other room and put on a Winnie the Pooh video. And basically you become part of this bizarre cult that the members of Skull and Bones, we're not talking about people who go into a construction business or they go into, you know, they just become mid-level people or even semi-rich people. You have like people who are, you know, high judges, presidents,
right?
You know, politicians of the highest order. Now, if you were trying to assemble something, you know, akin to, you know, WMDs not existing, you would want people on board who you know aren't going to talk. It's kind of frightening to me as a human being. Like, you know, you talked about, like I'm paraphrasing you earlier in the show, when you said basically someone is born to have a different set of values than a normal person and they believe that they're supposed to rule. But, you know, the rule is quite obviously not for the benefit of mankind. It's to have an elite power structure, you know, where these people seem to back one another up, putting it mildly, and can get us involved in things like, you know, going and taking out a country. And I must admit my own naivete that when that happened, and I'm, you know, generally not a war person, a monger, that if they had to go in and take something like that out, I could understand it. And then you find out when it's all over, it didn't even happen. So, I mean, my question in that statement is, you know, there seems to be something to it where, you know, I believe a low-level Freemason or a Shriner would know nothing about it and quite possibly be horrified. But these guys at the top of the pyramid don't seem to be so benign. They're not trying to raise money for kids with, you know, illnesses or diseases or such. They're out there to make sure that, you know, 99% of the wealth goes to themselves and 1% goes to everybody else. Am I naive in that? Or what do you come away after, you know, all this research and seeing these type of people who belong to these, some of them, who's in there? Johnson was in there. Who was in there? You name everybody. It's like they all belong to these organizations. Take the mic from me now. I've spoken too much in this question.
It's the ultimate power network. It's about power and control. And you're right. It's not about helping the masses. It's ruling over the masses, and it's maintaining that power and control. And when I say power and control, obviously wealth, great wealth, goes along with that. So that's part of that. But yeah, and it's almost the power of ritual too. You mentioned some of the rituals, and this stuff goes way back. It goes way a thousand years to this idea of almost bloodlines. They believe in like sacred bloodlines. Like, we are the ruling bloodlines. We were of the, you know, the ancient, you know, kings of the Merovingian kings of France, right, that are related to Jesus's bloodline. I mean, they believe in this stuff. And it, quite frankly, I don't know whether that's true or not, but they believe it.
Well, supposedly they believe in Jesus, so they're allowed to oppress and enslave 99% of the population. Right. There seems to be a slight miss, you know. Well, there's been a wrong turn somewhere in my GPS guidance system with this one.
Yeah, well, they don't care about what Jesus was preaching in his day. They care about the fact that they are the ruling class, right? So, you know, and it's so skewed. It's so nefarious. Like, I remember talking to Chris Milligan about it. It's like, this interview is upsetting me. Like, I'm really starting to not feel well because it's so dark and nefarious. And
well, because people suffer, it's making me sick to my stomach as we talk about it. Like, I feel.
Yeah.
My stomach is going through it.
Right. Because I started to be like, oh, maybe I don't want to go into this. But, like, you know, I, is, I don't want to go too deep into that, but listen, on a very basic level, these people think they are meant to rule, born to have all the power and wealth, hence the secret societies, elitist societies, Skull and Bones, there are others. And you're right, your average Freemason guy, is not going to know about all of this stuff. But like your 32nd level, who happens to be Skull and Bones and, was part of Skull and Bones in the 1950s, and listen, there's so many threads to this, because these are also the same people that would, going back a little further to the 1930s, they backed Adolf Hitler. They loved fascism. Make no mistake about it.
Well, they say fascists and dictators always pay the bills.
Well, you had a lot of people, big time industrialists, bankers in the United States in the 1930s that were literally funding the Nazi war machine, including George Bush Sr.'s father and all these, the Harrimans and the Bushes and the Prescott Bushes and the, again, Skull and Bones guys, and it's interesting. That's what really got to me when I was doing this research and I started together. You have people that Alan Dulles was one of the main principal people involved as the head of the CIA, formerly OSS, now CIA, of Operation Paperclip. What people don't understand is that Operation Paperclip wasn't just getting Wernher von Braun here to help us with rockets and the race to the moon.
Work to do with the Little Sisters of the Poor, am I correct?
You talk about MK Ultra scientists, people who were working in the prison camps and doing evil, horrible psychological experiments on the people from the camps. We got these people here. We're trying to get as many of them here as we could. People like the Dulles brothers and all these guys that were talking, Henry Ford. I mean, these guys were anti-Semitic is almost too. It's almost not a proper. Yeah, it doesn't do the.
Well, I mean, if you're financing the Nazi regime, now you're financing. Is it true that like we have till 6 o'clock? So I guess, William, like if you're the last half hour, please indulge me, sir, as they said in the 7 days in May. Like you have people who know full well, like I've heard it's at the point that they were backing them up that the death camps were in power. But that goes to figure. Now, people say, oh, come on, Bob, where did you get that information from? Let's look that up. But you could go back and see that in before the Nazis were known as the Nazis. Their scientists, maybe 10, 12 years before, the Nazi Party would come into being approximately, they had a, what would you even call it, a seminar at Madison Square Garden that the Harriman family sponsored, with the Bush family, Prescott, I believe it was, backing it up. And there was like you would be given as you entered the facility, they give out a nice book. Like if you went to see Paul McCartney in Wings, he has nothing to do with this, ladies and gentlemen. But if you hand the book out, it gives you to take home. And the event was dedicated to Harriman's mother. But basically what they were talking about was eugenics. And the correct me if I'm wrong. And the eugenics was basically to go after any undesirable to them would be mentally retarded people, people with Down syndrome, homosexuals, criminals, anybody that they wouldn't want in society. And the Nazis obviously went on to do this. So for these guys then to sponsor them, something seems to be amiss in this game of Clue. Could you pick it up from there, sir, please?
Yeah, just real briefly. I mean, it's and if that's not an elitist attitude, I don't know what is, right?
No, I cannot top this.
What's that?
I mean, it's a game. Like, can you top this? I just heard the old TV show. No, I cannot. I cannot top this. And then we keep electing them. It's like we know the name Bush, but we still elect the Bush family because they have name recognition.
Well, because we're so propagandized and mind controlled. And who was really good at that was the Nazis. And that's what they admired the Nazis for, a lot of the things they were doing, these people. And, you know, when you talk about that event, yeah, I mean, it was part of that whole attitude, you know. And it, what's weird is people think, well, come on, we defeated the Nazis in World War II. Yes, but we, and there were probably other reasons for that. But, like, we also got thousands of them, not only here, but also to Argentina. And a lot of them were literally war criminals. And then before the war, World War II was even over, we knew our enemy was communism. It was going to be communism. It was the Nazis that, you know, again, a lot of people in this country, you know, very powerful people in this country admired the Nazis. And they, you know, communism, on the other hand, was a problem. So that communism, and that's where all this Cold Warrior mindset came from. So, but people don't realize that this is our country, the CIA, the FBI, our Joint Chiefs of Staff, all these institutions, there is a lot of racism built into these institutions going back 200 years. So it's we are dealing with that. We're dealing with that kind of mentality that's extremely dangerous. And we see it today. It hasn't changed. So, you know, we're still dealing with it. There's always going to be.
Has it not changed because the same people are not people in an individual, but the same families would basically have the same percentages of money.
Correct. And they have all the power. They control the media. And that was the CIA. That was Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was Operation Mockingbird. He was in charge of that. And that was back then, making sure they had CIA that was infiltrated in the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the mainstream media. They needed to pull off. They could never have pulled off the assassination and gotten away with it if they didn't control the media. And they did.
Boy, have they taken over the media. Now, I've got the pitching coach on the phone with the bullpen, and he's telling me that William is indeed ready to go. So I just want to ask one more question before we hand over to him, and he gets the entire last hour, half hour, except for the 2 minutes where we have station identification. So I just want to ask about, I said three CIA people that I asked about, but you mentioned a fourth, so I don't want to leave them out and shortchange them. So please tell us about the fourth person whose father, I believe, was a photographer for the agency.
Yeah, Chana Gail Willis, her father was a photographer and he did aerial photography. He was in Naval Intelligence and the CIA. And he apparently was there that day taking – and his assignment, he had a team. And apparently one of the members on his team was Oswald. And he knew Oswald from Naval Intelligence. It was one of his team members. And their job was more of a photo survey. They no one really knew, you know, plausible deniability, but no one knew everything. People only knew what they needed to know. So it was like, your team needs to be in Dealey Plaza this day. You're going to be taking photographs of the president when he comes through and the motorcade. And they might have told him it's because we're doing training for, you know, protecting, who knows what they told them. But so they're there doing their job. They're following orders. And he was apparently by the picket fence. And he could never talk about, like, over time he would talk to Chana, and Chana would dig, right? She would, Dad, what happened? And it was really hard for him to talk about. And basically he said, the things he would tell her, he's like, I could tell you without a doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald did not even pick up a gun that day because he was part of my team. Was to be with, you know, if he's at the, you know, the Texas School Book Depository, he's on the grassy knoll. There was another guy, but they all had their job was to do whatever. And some of them found out what they, you know, like 2 weeks before, apparently found out what was really happening. Two of them, one committed suicide, and this is according to Chana and her father, and what her father told her. But if one committed suicide, the others try to get out, like, we're like, I don't want to be a part of this. And they're like, well, you're going to be a part of this, because if not, we're going to kill your entire family. And they would just threaten you with that. And what's interesting is that Oswald said that to Judith Berry Baker, which we haven't really talked about yet, but like I interviewed her for the book, and he told her, days before the assassination, he said, she goes, get out of this, go to Mexico. I'll meet you in Mexico. And he's like, I can't, they'll kill Marina and the kids. He's like, I don't even care about myself. And I'm just worried about you. I'm worried about Marina and the kids. And he I said, I have to stay. And he said, if I stay, at least I know there'll be one less gun pointed at Kennedy. This is what he apparently told Judith Vary Baker. And that is one of the most telling things I've ever heard in my life.
Well, the concept and of itself would also go play over to Jack Ruby, would it not? Why did Ruby, you know, what coerced him into firing those shots?
They had to kill Oswald. They had to. They had to kill Oswald. There's no way Oswald could have his day in court. He knew way too much. He had to die. They were probably supposed to kill him in the streets. They were probably supposed to kill him. They're probably supposed to kill him at the Texas School Book Depository. They were probably supposed to kill him at the Texas Theater. But somehow he'd survive and he was in custody. There was no way they could let him talk. And which is why they never.
Well, speaking of not letting him talk, speaking of not letting him talk, let's go back to my friend, the legendary researcher, William Mattson Law. Thank you for indulging me, sir. And back to you. Why don't you take us 2 minutes to the hour, so at that point I can say thank you to the station and our tech, Steve Roberts. William, back to you. No better guy to hand the ball to in the ninth inning.
No, you're too kind. You know, Jack, as you know, I'm drawn to the medical evidence. Everything medical appeals to me as far as this case goes. And I know that you interviewed Dr. David Mantic. He's discovered some very important things in his research, and I'd like you to talk a bit about him.
Yeah, he was. I was thankful that he talked to me. He of course is an MD, and he again dedicated a lot of time. I don't know how many times went to the National Archives and
nine times.
So eventually they're like, "You've been here times. Why do you want to come again?" And you know, so he's looking at all the X-rays and all the evidence of the wounds, the head wounds. And again, you know, and a lot of, I feel like that chapter is going to be really great for people who like the more nitty gritty detail of, okay, what was the angle of the bullet? You know, like what happened to the skull here? Right. So there's that part of it that's fascinating. Like, okay, wait a minute. How did this work? How many shots to the head? And David was just incredible. And I actually, it was really great because at the recent conference, this anniversary in Dallas, he was at, there were two conferences. He was at one of them. And I actually got a chance to go over to that conference and meet him. And he read your book. You didn't even have to send it to me. I already read it. It's like one of these avid readers. I'm like, oh, and I got nervous because I'm like, oh God, please like it. Please have liked it. And he's like, loved it. You did a great job. And I was like, oh, thank God. You know, he's just one of those guys. And you all command a great amount of respect because of the time you put into everything you've done. That's really all I have to say. Every one of you. I mean, every time I hear from one of you, the people who I interviewed say you did a good job. Like Phil Nilsen, I actually sat next to him and we had a table together, merchandise, when we were at the other conference. And I'm like, oh, God, I told my wife was there. I'm like, Phil Nilsen's right next to me. I'm like, I hope he liked the book. And he's like, I love the book. You did a great job. I'm like, oh, that would have been an uncomfortable weekend. If Phil would have been like, what did you do? Like, you know, that. But no, listen, David, incredible. So, so honored to have him in the book as well as everyone else. And again, I feel like that was one of those chapters. I feel like all the researchers in the section you're in, William, is way more detailed. Like, so in other words, in those chapters, it's a lot of detail about little things that are so important to help people understand the facts of what happened, when, where, during what time, whatever, all that, whether it's where the shots were came from, where the body, you know, what happened with the body, the autopsy, certainly disastrous. So all that information, I feel like those are in those chapters. But yeah, David was great. And again, really, like, I feel I love every chapter, right? Obviously, I edited all of them. I put them all together and I had to whittle them down some because it would have been way too long of a book. But I feel like they're all readable. So like with David, it's like he's going into this stuff, real medical, like this, the lateral this and the third this and the vertebrae. But it's understandable, and you come away from that interview saying to yourself, man, there's no way that that happened the way they say it happened. And David basically proves it.
I think he does.
Yeah.
I did a film shoot in 2002 where he attended, and along with Paul O'Connor and Jim Jenkins and Dennis David, who helped bring in the metal shipping casket, or gave orders to bring in the metal shipping casket. And Paul O'Connor and Jim Jenkins were two of the people that helped the doctors. And I also had a special person there, Jim Seibert, who was one of the FBI agents sent by J. Edgar Hoover. And we sat around the table and had an analysis of the autopsy photographs. And it was the first time, at least for Jim Seibert, who had been with these guys since that night in the morgue. And at that point, it had been 39 years.
Mm.
And we talked a lot about David and what he had done and what he discovered. It was absolutely fascinating. Have you seen any of that? Did you get a chance to see any of that?
No, I don't think I have not.
Oh my goodness.
Well, see that.
I'll have to get you a copy of that, but no, I knew David was right on the metal when with that stuff, and that's why I wanted to have him there. So, did you ever talk to anybody about the Cuban aspect of this whole thing?
Yeah, who did I? Larry Rivera got into that because he was talking about some of the things that happened with, you know, Oswald. Supposedly, whether or not he was in Cuba at the embassy, or the Mexican embassy,
mm-hmm.
started getting some of that stuff with that. You know, is great with that. Gets very detailed, and he talks about that. You know, for me, the things that I took from the interviews, as far as Cuba is concerned, is that the CIA. For years was trying to kill Castro any way they could. And this goes back to some of the stuff that was going on in New Orleans in the summer of 63, which is a section in the book. There were experiments going on, medical experiments. They were trying to weaponize cancer for the purposes of assassinating Castro and others who got in their way. This is CIA. And, you know, as people know, Ruby died of an aggressive cancer in prison. I mean, I'm just saying, like, they have this stuff, this technology, this weaponizing of medicine, of diseases. That's horrifying, because then you're playing God. But I feel like with Cuba, so you have that going on. You had, you know, the Joint Chiefs wanted to go into Cuba. They wanted any go into Cuba and basically annihilate it and wipe it off the map. And Kennedy knew what he was from this, obviously, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, you know, and he was in the Bay of Pigs to an extent as well. So he's like, okay, you know, I'm dealing with people who do not care what they have to do in order to get Castro out. As too. There were a lot of very wealthy people in this country who lost a lot of money when Castro took over. There were a lot of interests, including mob interests in Cuba with the casinos and other things that were happening there with the trading and some other stuff that really hurt pocketbooks in the United States. So there was even more of a reason for them to get rid of Castro. So you had all this going on, but it was interesting. I never thought there was enough from what I heard and read and what I was told by people. It seems as if there were plans in place where they were going to try to kill Castro. And there was something known as Operation Northwoods, where they were going to have a false flag event and blame it on the Cubans. So they're going to have really a commercial jetliner crashing. I know this sound, it's eerie to think of this, that that's what they were thinking of doing in the early 1960s, that it would crash passengers, crash into a building, blame it on Castro, invade Cuba. And they, the Joint Chiefs told, informed Kennedy of this plan. And Kennedy's like, there is no way in hell you're doing that. Because it was, it would cause nuclear, even though we had first strike capability, they were looking at it as a number. If we lose a couple million, that's fine. Because again, it's that elitist attitude, right? It's like, who cares about the masses? We'll be in our bunkers. So they didn't care. So I think that they turned that into, why don't we just move things around a little bit and use those same tactics we were going to use to take Castro out, and then use it to take Kennedy out, and use the same things we have in place to cover, that we want to cover it up. And it all goes back to the CIA and their modus operandi and the way they did things. And they were very, very good at it. Make no mistake, they were masters at that.
I did an interview years ago with a man named Gene Wheaton. Are you familiar with Gene Wheaton?
No.
You can see the interview on YouTube. I was not familiar with him either. And I was working on a book that's going to be out next year called Shadows and Light. It's on RFK. And I was going to be in California to do some research on the book. And our mutual friend Larry Hancock called me and said, got this guy, Gene Wheaton, and we don't know much about him, but we'd like to see if you can locate him. And he sent along a bunch of papers, and he had given a story to the Records Review Board to a woman named Ann Budimir, and then he couldn't find her, so he wanted to know where she was, Gene Wheaton. So I said I would do it. And as it turned out, I get a call from a friend of mine that she said, you know, we don't know much about Gene Wheaton, but as you know, a lot of people have died in the intervening years dealing with the Kennedy case. We don't know this guy, so we have talked it over, and we think you need to make out your will. So I
wow.
didn't do that. I thought it was a throwaway thing. I was too busy working on the book, and it was like a throwaway thing for me. And so I went out there, and I did it. I interviewed him, and it was I go out there. I got to tell you, this is about the struggle of what you have to go through. And you know this when you're trying to interview someone. I called him up, and he acquiesced to me and answered a bunch of my questions, and I wanted to interview him in person because it just goes better for me. And so he said yes, he would see me. So we made arrangements to do this. And when I was out in California doing research, one of my interviews didn't go like I had planned. And I thought, well, we have to fly to Carson City and do this other interview. So I did, and I was really late getting back. I took the red eye along with my partner, Mark Sobel, because we were working on a documentary. So, you know, I'm sitting there, and we're having coffee the next morning, and it was a rough gig. And I said, you know, we have an appointment to see Gene Wheaton. I'm not sure what time it was. And Mark, my friend, took some notes off the coffee table, and he said, oh, we were supposed to be there at 9 o'clock. Well, it's already 9:25. So now I had to call him up and beg him to let me come out and interview him. And he chastised me a lot for not being on time. And we were like 125 miles away. And so we got stuck in road construction, all that. We get to his house. He doesn't want to let me in. He says, you know, I wasted all morning waiting for you. You've wasted my time. And I talked him into it. And when we get in there, and I keep in mind, this is not for me. This is for a friend of mine that's doing a book. So I get in there, finally talk him into letting me get in there. And we turn the camera on him. And he starts talking about how he was hanging out with these people that he got involved with over a year and a half's time, a bunch of Cubans. And they start talking about how they knocked off JFK and got away with it. So about a quarter of the way into this, I'm realizing what I have on my hands, because he starts talking about, well, I'm the whistleblower for Iran-Contra. And he knew Oliver North and William Casey. He told me this whole story. And you know, now he's got me by the throat because now I grasp what I've got here. I had no idea. And so I just wrote this chapter. And so it's fresh in my mind. And we come out of that thing and come out of that. And he told us all kinds of things. And we begged him to let us stay and come back. And he would only give us a certain amount of time. And we got in the car to leave. And my film partner, Mark Sobel, his eyes are as big as saucers. And he looks at me after what he's heard. And he says, "I'm just the camera guy. They never kill the camera guy." I mean, once in a while, you stumble upon something that you don't grasp, you know, is what you're getting into.
Right.
And I didn't take it serious at all.
And then the next thing you know is you know something that probably very few people know.
Oh, it was, I got the feeling, because I was like, you know, feet from him, across from him. And you know how you could pick up on somebody's vibes, you know? And and this guy was looking me right in the eyes. It was everything he was telling me, whether it was true or not, he believed it was true. So
wow,
I got the feeling there just was no bull about this guy, that what he was telling me was the truth as he knew it. And I came out of that interview thinking that I have gotten as close to a person that was really at the heart of this thing as anybody has gotten. It was,
that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, when you read the chapter, you let me know when the book comes out.
Okay.
It was really an experience, but you can go on to YouTube and it's been posted up there, but that's the backstory behind all of that, or at least part of it. Is, you know, before we go, and we always run out of time, is there anything that you really wanted to talk about in this book that you really wanted people to know above all else?
I think the important takeaway from this is, because people sometimes say, and I've heard this before, it doesn't matter anymore, 60 years ago, let it go. And I couldn't disagree more. And I think doing this book really solidified the fact that, for me anyway, it matters very much. And it still matters. And there have been ripple effects since the assassination that we're still feeling today. And I think that this, in 1963, we were at our pinnacle of everything. I feel like there was this idea of American exceptionalism, where we were great. We wore the white hats. We had defeated the Nazis. We had, you know, in World War II, everything we did, we had the highest quality of life. The minute Kennedy was killed, that American exceptionalism began to erode, and it's eroded since. And nothing's ever been the same. It's all been worse. Certainly politically, it's been a disaster. And I think that young people need to understand that. I have a 21-year-old son, and I wrote this book for him, you know, and other people, younger generations, who need to understand that, you know, the Kennedy assassination still matters. I mean, it happened. You need to know, you know, possibly who did it and why they did it. Because then you can understand what we're going through as a country today. And that's what I hope people read this book. I hope they read this book and they see all these incredible people telling their stories, and they gain insight, and they may be able to put some puzzle pieces together as far as the assassination is concerned. And then they can take that information and go from there. So again, they can capture and then go and get your books, right? They could, you know, read David and then find out more about David's research. And that applies to every chapter, and there's something that interests them. So I got to find out, and then they do it, and they're critical thinkers, right? And they're open minded, and they're objective, and they go about it that way, right? And that's the only way we are going to heal from what I believe was one of the most horrible things, if not the most horrible thing that's ever happened in this country. And nothing's been the same since. I think we could all agree on that.
Absolutely. You quoted from my interview from the book where I said, whoever pulled that trigger killed not only John F. Kennedy, but killed 58,000 Americans in Vietnam. And that right. kind of got some comments, but I still stand by that statement. I truly believe it.
It's a powerful statement, and it's an accurate statement. And it couldn't be more accurate. Not only 58,000 Americans, but a million Vietnamese. I mean, and then we can go on and on from there, right? Just keep going. Yeah,
absolutely. But before we wrap this up, we have a mutual friend that you interviewed that is in the book, and that's Don Jeffries. Tell us a little bit about your experiences with Don. He's a somewhat controversial, but he digs for the truth, however he sees it. And he's not afraid to say
yeah,
it.
You know, what I love about Don, I know I sound like a broken record, but I so enjoyed basically every one of these interviews. I think the thing with Don is that people have to face reality, and as Americans, we face reality. And the perfect example of that is the people in Europe when this first happened. They knew there was something wrong. They knew it was a conspiracy. It was only Americans that couldn't accept it. And I found that fascinating. A couple of people told me that. And there was some, you know, headlines from other countries, and it was obvious to them, like, okay, there's a conspiracy, right? And then when Ruby killed Oswald, they were like, oh, yeah. Because these countries have been around a long time, and they've had their own conspiracies that they've had to deal with and heal from. Right. So they understood that. What I love about Don is that he goes right into, you know, it's like, listen, that we have a hidden history. And it's just like it's the title of his book. And it's like our history is replete with some dark stuff. And we have to come to terms with that as citizens of this country, because that's the only way we're going to be able to make things any better and heal from some of the horrible things that have happened. So I love that. And then and one of the things that I definitely wanted to put, because again, I, you know, it was a long interviews and I had to cut him down a little bit, but one of the things that he writes about in his another book that he wrote, Bullyocracy, is the idea. Yeah. And, you know, he talks about, and this goes back to what we were talking about, an elitist kind of bully. We live in a society where we accept and applaud almost the bully, right? The person who gets ahead doing whatever he has to, stepping on other people, right? We, you know, very capitalistic kind of mindset. And how that kind of idea of a bullyocracy, opposed to a democracy, you know, is something that is real. It's something that is a psychological kind of, is an undercurrent in our society. And I found that fascinating. It's almost like a separate book. I mean, obviously he wrote a book about it, but I tie it right in because I felt, yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. Look, what are we talking about here? We're talking about guys who are essentially bullies. But we're going to get their way no matter what, whether it's Lyndon Johnson or Alan Dulles or, you know, J. Edgar Hoover or Henry Rockefeller or whoever. And they use their power and influence and wealth to get what they want. And they do it they don't care about who they have to kill or step over to get what they want. So yeah, Don's great. But this is reality what Don's talking about. And these aren't conspiracy theories. This is real stuff. And that's what I love about Don. He get, you know, yeah, because people are going to attack that. Oh, there's no way our government would, you know. But, yeah, our government did and does, you know, like, you know, and will again, right? You know, I mean, unless there's some way we can stop it.
You know, the sad thing is, no matter how much we research it, no matter how much we talk about it, no matter how much we fight against what happened, the sad truth is they got away with it.
Right. And that's sad. I remember you and I actually talking about this. Yeah, they got away with it. And that is so sobering.
Well, with that, I'm going to turn it back to our host, Bob Wilson, for the cleanup.
Well, we want to thank you, William Matzenlaw, very much for being here and classing us up today. And the book we've been focusing on today is Killing Kennedy, Exposing the Plot, the Cover-Up, and the Consequences by Jack Roth. And as we have a good 3 minutes left before we have to say goodnight and give a station identification, I just want to ask you, how did you get the fellow who did the foreword for your book? Tell us a little bit about him in 3 minutes, if you may.
Oh, yeah. That was incredible. Cyril Weck, the icon in this field of study. I just said, I got to reach out to him. I got to try. Because I had all the – part of my problem was I had so many great people I interviewed for the book that I was running out of people to actually write the foreword for the book. So, you know, I thought about Oliver Stone, and it's like, well, that might take that. Yeah, that was a long shot. But then I'm like, you know, I think – I just wrote a really nice email, very professional, very nice email to Dr. Weck. And I said, I told him what I was doing. I might've sent him a manuscript at the time. It was a rough manuscript. I sent him a couple things. And I said, if you'd like, it would be an honor if you wrote the foreword. And wouldn't you know, he got back to me within a couple of days and said he'd do it. And he did it. And I was like, I remember telling my wife, you're not going to believe this. And then he's like, oh, I've seen him on TV. I'm like, yeah, he's a big deal. And for him to write the foreword, it was just the icing on the cake. It really was. It was great. I was so lucky, so fortunate.
And we mentioned before, we still have a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to ask, you know, people say, why does it matter in 2023? You guys had spoken on it, and in my mind, our country, and you alluded to it, basically changed for the worse with a capital W when Kennedy, you know, was shot with those bullets in Dealey Plaza. And, you know, one thing researchers speak of is like, you know, if Kennedy had won re-election 8 years, if Bobby had come in and won 2 elections, that's, you know, a total of 16. If my math is correct, maybe William is smart. He can check me. And then we had the third. If Teddy had come in, that would be possibly another 16 years. And, you know, it's kind of strange. John with bullets, Bobby with bullets, and Teddy, you know, had a plane crash somewhere in there, which William was talking to me about the other night. So I think it really did matter in 2020. You know, it does matter in 2023 what happened then. And I want to thank you for reminding us of just how important that was. And if people want to find the book, what's the best place to go? Is it Amazon.com or where should they look?
Yeah, you can go to Amazon.com and you can find it there. And you can also go to, I have a website. It's JackRothAuthor.com. And you can go there. And they can click on, there's links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and there's some other stuff there of mine, some earlier books that I've written on there. But, yeah, either one, they could get it. They'll find it pretty easily.
Well, I thank William Matzenlaw for coming on and bringing all he does to the show, which meant a great deal to me. And I thank Jack Roth, who's done a really nice job with this book. People might say there are many books out there, and I think between me and William, we've looked at a lot, and this is one that I would definitely pick out and call a keeper. So I thank Mr. Ross so much for being there. I thank my friend William for being here. So everybody have a good night, and thank you for not passing us by, and we send a Shake and Wake Radio Network call out. It's a good place to go to find out some good things for you. So go to the Shake and Wake Radio Network. And we thank our producer very much, Steve Roberts, who's always a help and a great guy to have around in a pinch. So good night, everybody.